for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's November 2021, and this is episode 263, which is a spoiler-filled conversation about the Marvel film Eternals, directed by Chloe Zhao. On this episode, I'm joined by Cole Burgett, who is a recent seminary graduate and a graduate of the Moody Bible Institute. He is also an author for the website Christ and Pop Culture. Cole has written an online exclusive film review of Eternals, and it's called Free Will, The Power of Choice, and Skin in Eternals. You can access it on our website, equip.org, for free if you're a subscriber to our journal. For those who don't yet subscribe and would like to read this article, please go to our website, equip.org, to subscribe. Cole, it's good to have you on again.
Always good to be here. Thank you.
And so we're talking about Eternals, Marvel Eternals, which is in theaters now, and it's the latest installment in the Marvel superhero universe. It's been directed by Oscar winner Chloe Zhao, who made quite a stir earlier this year when her very interesting indie film, Nomadland, went on to win the Best Picture Oscar, and it featured a lot of non-actors in it, and it almost has a documentary style to it, and it's very quiet, and there's not really plot. It's just very character driven. And so she goes from that kind of a film to this big blockbuster that was recently released. And the Eternals is part of the Marvel comic universe, starting in the comics. It was released in 1976. And I guess just for this fall, it follows another release, the Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, which is taking some of the lesser known Marvel characters and making them into films. And so the Eternals film, it has a lot of different philosophical things going on in there. I'd like you to tell us a little bit about the movie, but before that, if you know anything about the comics, you know, why is this particular, using these particular superheroes, a little bit different for the Marvel approach that we've all gotten used to, you know, with the big blockbuster films and the characters that we know really well?
Sure. So the Eternals is actually kind of interesting for Marvel, as you pointed out. And in other podcasts, we've talked about sort of the difference between Marvel and DC, which is, you know, they're traditionally, I guess, what you'd call rival companies. So there's sort of competing ideas going on. But one of the things I pointed out is what the two companies do best are actually very, very different. And the analogy I've kind of gone to is Marvel deals with very street level superheroes. You tend to not have very many people like Superman running around. They're usually very vulnerable, very human, almost as average as you can be, with some slight exceptions. They're just people, is my point. DC, on the other hand, will tend to play in the realm of gods and monsters, a little more cosmic ideas. And what makes Eternals real different from Marvel is that it kind of goes in that direction, which, if you know the history of the book, kind of makes a lot of sense, because it was 1970, I think it was, Jack Kirby, the guy who created the Eternals, who, if you know anything about comics, the name Jack Kirby he's the guy. one of, if not the biggest, next to Stan Lee, and a names in the comic book industry. Jack Kirby actually left Marvel to go to DC Comics. And while he was there, he began working on this story that pulls from mythology and science fiction. And he started developing this idea. Now, what's interesting, what he pulls from, if you've ever watched the TV series Ancient Aliens, the ideas that thread through that series and the theories that were becoming popular right around that time by guys like Eric Von Däniken and a fellow by the name of Zachariah Sitchin, those ideas, those ancient aliens ideas that maybe humanity's cultures and just civilization in general sort of began with these visits from these extraterrestrial entities that kind of ushered humanity into civilization. Those were the ideas that interested Kirby. And so he started playing around with those concepts. He eventually went back to Marvel and he began developing that idea at Marvel under the title of The Eternals. So it's very different for usual Marvel fare. It's very cosmic in scope. It's very celestial, very extraterrestrial, very, very weird in some regards. And that's just a little bit about the backstory as far as the comics are concerned.
I know in reading for this interview that Chloe Zhao, the director of Marvel's Eternal, just as part of her pitch, she mentioned ancient aliens. So that is a big, you know, part of it. And I want to tell our listeners, if they have missed it in the past, that we did a podcast on ancient aliens on the Postmodern Realities podcast. And so that's episode 110, which is a long time ago, more than 100 episodes, but it's back in 2019. And you can look for that on our website or on our YouTube channel. And we did talk about that whole series and if, in fact, ancient terrestrials visited Earth. But with regard to Marvel's Eternals, it's right now, I'm wondering also before I ask you a little bit more about the movie, if you think Christians should watch it, because the last time we talked about Dune, and one of the comments that we got on our YouTube channel was that Christians have made movies into idols and they are wicked, and we really need to be careful about what we put in, you know, before our eyes, because we will be responsible before God for that. And so is there something, especially there is a slight, not major, but there is a queer storyline in it. And so is this even, you know, appropriate for, you know, Marvel's really popular with kids and teenagers and so forth. Is this appropriate for Christians at all or children to watch this film?
It's a good question. And I do want to point out there is very much truth to what you mentioned from the comment about being careful about what you put in front of your eyes. And that probably where this conversation will go. And then this interview will get into some interesting territory with that particular point. But that's very true. And you have to be wary of that. As far as, like you mentioned, having the one gay couple in the film, as far as whether or not a Christian should view something like this. Like you just said, Marvel is very popular with teenagers in general, young adults. That's sort of what I would say Marvel kind of targets, especially with that PG-13 rating, young adults, things like that. The flip side of the coin is, you know, it's very hard to separate these things from the culture that we're inundated in. So whether or not your kids sit down and watch this in Eternals, your kids are going to hear about it at school. Your kids are going to hear about it from their friends. I think as a responsible Christian, probably the least you can do is at least be familiar with what is popular right now, with what especially your kids are going to be seeing. So yeah, I think it's worth Christians at least being familiar with it and paying attention to it. And when I think you get right down to it, it actually has some pretty interesting ideas in the storytelling that the Bible does have a very interesting perspective on, and Christians can interact with in some pretty profound ways that people who don't really have a religious inclination can.
Well, one of the things, getting back to this film, that has been true about the press regarding it and some of the reviews is that it's been quite polarizing, not only with reviewers, but also from fans who have said that this is not an appropriate Marvel movie at all. It doesn't fit into the pantheon of Marvel movies. So why do you think that this particular film has had such a polarizing reception?
Yeah, I was aware of some of these reviews going into the film. And as I've said before, I really try to avoid these things. I think the real value of film criticism has been lost in recent years. Criticism should be about interacting with a film's ideas in its own context, sorting out what the director and writers are trying to say through a story told in pictures and dialogue. But it seems now almost that critics have become like these gatekeepers, having been given this power over to sort of tell you what is acceptable to like and what isn't. This is the whole Rotten Tomatoes idea, the movie that has a less than a certain percentage of critical approval, a number that is really quite arbitrary when you read some of these reviews, which are very middle of the road-ish. I think this is detrimental, and it's disheartening to filmmakers. So just by way of example, I've read some glowing reviews by critics who have completely missed the point of a film. And Marvel films along these lines come to mind, actually. It's Black Panther, for example, which we were talking about earlier. Every time I hear someone say Killmonger is right, I very quickly remind them, no, Killmonger is dead. He may have a nuanced perspective, but he is dead. The narrative rejects the antagonist's philosophy. There's a reason he is beaten and dies at the end. That's the narrative saying he is wrong, and this is what it cost him. Two and two still make four, and that's just how narrative works, folks. So on one level, I think with a film like Eternals, with regard to the polarizing critical response, you have the issue of a culture that is far more interested in reading into movies, what in biblical studies we call eisegesis, than in analyzing an artifact for what the writer-director is saying, what we call exegesis. We're taking from rather than reading into. And beyond this, you have the confines of, I guess, what you'd call cultural expectations. People feel like they know what Marvel movies are, what they're supposed to be, and how they're supposed to operate. There's lots of action, some snappy dialogue, and very kinetic pacing. In that way, Eternals feels like the antithesis of this. The action is pretty limited. I mean, it's there, of course. It's a Marvel film. But the dialogue is far less crackling, and it's much more introspective. And then the pacing is quite contemplative. It's much slower. Some of the reviews I looked at after the film, writing the article and then preparing for this interview, I saw the word boring being used a lot. And so it feels very much like it's designed to upend expectations. And you see a widespread response that is very similar to how Zack Snyder's Justice League films were received, where people, even critics, sort of like their superheroes to be separate from lofty ideas. And I just don't think you can get away from that. Chloe Zhao, the director, actually cited Zack Snyder's take on Superman in Man of Steel as an inspiration for this film. And I think that probably shows to one degree that maybe Snyder was even a bit ahead of his time in anticipating where the superhero film genre must inevitably go. So all this to say, I think some people at Disney probably knew this film would be flirting with a polarizing reception. And, you know, credit where it's due. I'm really glad they stuck with it because I think the product, despite the polarizing response, is actually pretty interesting. And it's probably because it's interesting that it's getting such a divisive response.
I want to thank everyone who's a faithful listener to this podcast. We're really grateful for the ways in which you help us get the word out about the Postmodern Realities podcast by simply telling a friend about it or linking a favorite episode on your social media accounts. Of course, I want to recommend again that you enter the contest that we're having for a free subscription to the Christian Research Journal. It ends next month on December 31st. We'd like it if more people would go and give us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts. A short sentence about what you like about this podcast will enter you into the contest. And if you are already a subscriber, it makes a great gift to someone else who would be interested in our content. So we would like to get more starred reviews up there too, but please do go ahead and give us a written review and enter into that contest. In addition, you can subscribe for $33.50 to the Christian Research Journal, and that grants you access to all of our online exclusive content like this review for Marvel's Eternal on our website, equip.org, where you can also subscribe to our magazine. Without getting too deep into a theological discussion of the predestination versus free will debate, that is a topic that actually you link in this film as one of its themes. So what do you think that the Marvel Eternals film perspective is about free will and predestination?
Yeah, these ideas are definitely in there. Eternals is a huge sweeping film that spans thousands upon thousands of years, all of human history, really, chronicled in a span of about 2.5 hours. And some of the core philosophical ideas here have to do with free will, the power of choice, one's sense of purpose, and of course, the cost of love. This is where I can't say the film really does anything we haven't seen before in different capacities, but it is new for a Marvel film. The big sort of twist for these characters in the movie is that they learn they are these artificial life forms, these eternals, as they're called, learn that they have been created by these entities called celestials. And their purpose in being sent to a specific planet is to enable the birth of a new celestial, which is going to consume all life on that planet as it is being born. And their job is to sort of preserve the planet long enough for the celestial to be born and then consume all life. So the Eternals have lived thousands of years believing that they have been on Earth to protect it, only to learn that they are actually on Earth to ensure the birth of a new celestial, which is going to destroy the planet and them as it's born, at which point their consciousness will simply be transferred to a new body and their mission will continue. So the ethical dilemma at the heart of the film is, do they actually have the luxury of choice, or are they fated to do exactly what they are programmed to do? Do they even have a will in this whole situation? And the drama of it is that the Eternals, especially Cersei, played by Gemma Chan, they've grown to like humans. They've become very empathetic with humans, and they don't necessarily want to see humans destroyed. Now, to the film's credit, we do see these characters struggle with this. One of the characters actually refuses to help the Eternals when they side with the humans and just disappears for the third act of the film. He just bows out. And another one tries to fight them when the rest choose to defend humanity. But ultimately, the choice to rebel against their programming wins out. And that's the great emotional catharsis at the film's end. So certainly the film's perspective is that there is always a choice. The thing that I find most appealing about the film is that it actually shows consequences. The character of Icarus, which is played by Richard Madden, is, for my money, the most nuanced character Disney has ever put to screen under the Marvel brand. He cannot bring himself to kill the character of Cersei because he loves her, but that means he then can't stop her from killing the Celestial, even though he himself is loyal to the Celestials. And the guilt that overwhelms him in the aftermath leads him to commit suicide. I mean, it's a very dark but powerful character arc. So I think the film's perspective on these ideas is that there's always a choice, but with every choice comes a consequence. And that's a more mature take on this subject than a film like this has any right to have. So that's kind of my initial thinking on the movie's perspective on those topics.
You know, we've mentioned that this earlier, that her inspiration was Zack Snyder, and we've mentioned that this is not the typical approach to Marvel. So do you think it's surprising that Hollywood made this film? Because it seems like, given its reception as very controversial and divided among fans and reviewers, it seems like it was a risk for Chloe Zhao to make this film in such a different way than people were expecting, which kind of turned that Marvel formula on its head a bit?
I do find it surprising. Well, here's how I'll say this. Maybe not surprising that Hollywood is capable of producing it, but that it's included in a film as mainstream as this after the response that Snyder's films received. It is a risk for the filmmakers and producers, and clearly the critical response shows that this is a divisive film. So some people like the new direction, others don't. But I do think this is a film, again, like Snyder's DC films, that will be remembered as being far better than it was upon initial release, because it actually deals with some timeless themes and concepts. A lot of Marvel movies feel, to me at least, like a flash in the pan. I don't think I've seen more than a handful of them more than once, and honestly, I remember nothing about most of them. Eternals is different. If nothing else, that ending is palpably powerful and will stick with me and has stuck with me since the film came out. I often, you know, joke with my friends that the only film that ever put me to sleep in the theater was an Avengers film. It was Age of Ultron, and it was the ending. This sort of mess of incoherent CGI where nothing felt real or tangible. Eternals is the exact opposite. There's a lot of big CGI stuff, but the beats are the most human of moments, and there really is some tremendous acting in there from both Gemma Chan and Richard Madden especially. So I don't think it's necessarily surprising that Hollywood is capable of producing it. That being said, I do think it's really interesting that this is the direction Marvel has sort of chosen to go in. And I do think with time, when you're looking back and you sort of see the direction that the stories take, it tends to look a little better than it did upon initial release. It's very hard, I think, to trust a lot of the initial reception to a film when it comes out, because you're just so entrenched in the culture and the ideas of the moment. The movies that stand the test of time, those are the ones that really stick out to you. And the themes that this movie deals with, the ideas that it plays with, very much like Snyder's Justice League films, are timeless in concept. And I do think looking back on them from a future perspective, they will hold up much better than a lot of people might initially think they would.
So I want to talk about your review that you wrote for us, and you kind of look at the relationship between the characters Icarus and Circe, and you call their relationship really the backbone of this entire film. So what led you to frame things in your review around their relationship in particular?
Well, I think that's what the film does. The emotional through line of the film is this relationship between Icarus and Circe. From the moment they meet when they first awaken, which I'm pretty sure is the opening of the film, to the moment they part, which is at the very end, that's the heart of the movie. And the way the film handles the texture of this relationship, for my money, is really quite mature. We see their relationship develop very early on into something that is pretty much monogamous. And we get the sense that they're these kinds of celestial mates or whatever. I mean, they go through that whole ancient marriage ceremony of sorts. So what we see are two people within the context of some kind of marriage. Again, which is just wildly different for a Marvel film to deal with, in a way, married heroes going through an emotionally turbulent breakup. It really is what it is. So you have these two people within the context of some kind of marriage, but they are of very different minds. They are very different people. And eventually they grow apart and Icarus leaves. And that's a blow to Circe. I mean, she really struggles with this. But the drama of the present day storyline in the film really picks up with Icarus re-entering the picture. And so there's a lot of this understated conflict between the two of them throughout the film. And I thought this was really kind of interesting how they did this, where the two come back, but it's not a quick, you know, return. And it's not something that you just have one conversation about and then you work through. There's a lot of unstated conflict between them throughout the length of the movie. And it's almost a film that is sort of overcrowded, I think. It would have been completely fine to lose some of the side characters and focus the entire film upon Icarus and Circe and make the whole thing about this, you know, tragic love affair that stretches across the eons of human history. But that's not quite what the film becomes. Their relationship, though, is definitely the centerpiece, and it has some pretty powerful moments as far as I'm concerned. The two characters come into conflict, Circe siding with the humans and Icarus with the Celestials. And they come to blows, but ultimately Icarus can't bring himself to kill her, and so he relents and allows her to kill the Celestial. And he is shattered by grief in the aftermath and kills himself. It's not the thing you would expect to see, especially in a Disney movie, but there it is.
And, you know, when we're talking about this, these characters, they do kind of have this, like, Hindu-esque marriage ceremony. And in depicting their joining together, there is would be characterized as a sex scene, but it's not, I mean, it doesn't really show anything. It's very brief, but it's implied, I guess it was implied. And you mentioned that in a screening, some Christians who saw this film commented about this, you know, implied sex scene. Why do you think that this scene has gotten reaction? Is it because it's in the Marvel films? Is it because it's more having a humanizing aspect of them, having a love, you know, a relationship together?
Yeah. So this is actually pretty interesting, I think. There is a mild sex scene between the two of them. And honestly, depending on how much weight you put on that term, I'm sure some people would argue that it's not even a sex scene. They aren't really doing anything, but they are very clearly in an intimate moment. And the camera doesn't cut away all at once, which is sort of like the thing that PG-13 films do. But it doesn't do that. It kind of lingers with them. And the response to this, particularly from Christians, interests me. When I was in undergraduate school and seminary, the general characterization of Hollywood is that it's all about sexing things up, you know? And that was true in the 70s and 80s, but now? Are you kidding me? That these major tentpole PG-13 blockbusters are petrified of two opposite gendered grown-ups in a committed, monogamous, marital relationship doing what opposite gendered grown-ups in committed, monogamous, marital relationships do. You just don't find this stuff in these big blockbusters anymore. If sex comes up, it's usually handled in a very flippant way. You get a bit of risque joke making, you cut to some flesh, but not too much because actors have clauses in their contracts. Then you cut away, you imply everything, and then suggestion and seduction lingers in the memory enough to add, you know, some dangerous stimulation to mental appetites. But that's Hollywood. Now, the church, I would argue we're pretty obsessed with sex. It's just understood that a men's meeting at church is going to bring up the topic of pornography at the very least. We hold seminars about sex and elevate it to a level of borderline mysticism. I mean, you listen to some pastors prattle on about sex and you think the only two places you're closest to God is in the sanctuary and the bedroom. And it's exactly what C.S. Lewis warned about. Sex becoming too serious that it misses all the inherent humor and awkwardness of it. And it's funny. Sex is funny. And half the reasons Christians have lost all credibility with this topic as far as the culture is concerned is because we like to see ourselves as the people in the room who render everyone else silent, awkwardly silent, with, you know, holier-than-thou claims, when there really is absolutely nothing more basic that we have in common with the world besides the need to eat and sleep than sexual appetite. Now, what I'm not saying is that we view it in the same way. We most certainly don't. But there is a healthy medium here. The fact of the matter is, audiences in 2021 are shallow, less emotionally mature, and completely unable of seeing sexuality as having mystery, transcendence, or even beauty. It is fluid, whatever that means. In a pornographic society, which we absolutely live in, driven by technology, there's nothing transcendent anymore. I mean, how could there be with this much technology? I have a film director friend who always jokes that he should just go into porn because that's where the money is. And he isn't wrong about that. It's a billion-dollar industry. And the church comes in, as always, a day late and a dollar short, trying to gussy it all up with our cheap spirituality because we know the Bible talks about sex in some poetic language, but we're not really interested in what the Bible says or even what it implies. So we just do what the world does, but differently, and we call it Christian mingle. Now, I was talking about this very topic after the film with one of my close friends and mentors, one of my undergraduate professors, and she said that there's no sense of pause in relationships anymore, no chance to long or even miss someone because of texting and FaceTime and Skype and whatever. There's not even a chance to keep secrets. What shocks people about showing a little skin in Eternals is not the horror of a sex scene. No, it's really the hint of honest sexual detail presented without ridicule or pretense to indicate passion and the reality of the gripping nature of this couple's love expressed sexually. And I would argue it's necessary for this film. It's necessary because one of those characters is going to kill themselves by the end of the film, due in part to the memory of that relationship. What shocks people is not a little skin showing. It's the taking seriously of the act and the unironic portrayal of it that doesn't read like a softcore porn flick. It's very hard to stage well, but the scene works in Eternals because it is thoughtfully and carefully done. It's staged with care, There's nothing quite flippant about it. There's nothing very risque, but it's very adult and it's very mature. And I think that sort of is what underlies a lot of the response to this scene in this movie.
You know, you talked about this movie tackling a lot of philosophical topics. I mean, we can't go on all of them, and you couldn't, talk about all of them in your review. But I found, because there were so many characters, I did think, though, and I'm not familiar with the comics, that she tried to get focus on each one of the characters, and it just was almost kind of like too much, you know, with all the ideas going on. But one was to pose the question, I think, that Sprite, who was the little, I don't know, was that she's supposed to be junior high age or a little kid? She's just like on the precipice, I guess, of becoming an adult, and she never can be. Is that there's something, and speaking about their relationship spanning the centuries, there's something not right about being eternal. There's something that you can't really live. You can't really experience that. And so when she asks to not be an eternal anymore, it's kind of like, yes, I realize the ramifications of it, but to truly live in the now and not live forever would be better.
Yeah, that's certainly an idea that the film deals with. It's again, this is one of those things that's not quite new. I mean, any movie that sort of deals with somebody who lives forever, the lesson that always comes about is that's usually not the best thing. Logan deals with the same ideas. The Wolverine films deal with the same ideas. It is a common idea. I think when I have these conversations with Christians, you know, we kind of always run to the idea, well, you know, according to scripture and resurrection, there's a point where we live forever. Yeah, but there's a lot of different things happening contextually at that point. And I do think the idea that you could live forever, but in a broken world, is something you should probably reject. so in that regard, I would say the movie has a pretty interesting perspective on that through the character of Sprite. But you're absolutely right. I think I mentioned this. The film does feel stretched. It's very long as it is. And, you know, to the director's credit, she really does, I would say, give each character enough screen time to develop a distinct personality. Every character really does feel like they have a perspective and a character arc. The character of Thena, which we haven't even touched on, that Angelina Jolie plays, is also just a very, very interesting character. But I do think, honestly, I think it was a little overstuffed. You could have lost some of these side characters and focused the film. And I think also to go back to a previous question, you ask about the polarizing response. Well, I think this is just part of it. This movie, the ideas that this movie plays with, the characters that this movie includes, this entire movie could have been its own series, spanning thousands of years in different eras of human history. But instead, it's all put into one 2.5-hour film. And so it probably feels very bloated. A lot of the reviews I read talked about, well, it's exposition heavy. Well, yeah, it's going to be. I mean, you're covering literally human civilization from its beginning. It's just the way the story has to be told. So, yeah, I would agree.
I would like to see this film in order to really appreciate it. And I think in order to make the reception to its characters just be more, I guess, connect more with the audience that, you know, has been divided on it, is I think some of these characters would be good on a one-off series like they did, you know, for the different Marvel characters that they're doing. You know, Hawkeye's about to start on Disney+. And I would like to see some of these, you know, themes explored more. I would like to see the theme, you know, Sprite, what happens to her when she decides to do this, or Druig. I thought Druig was fascinating. It was just here and there that he was in the film, but at some sense he's got this, you know, this idea that he wants to stop all the wars and the way that humanity treats one another. So wouldn't it be better if he could just do that magically? Wouldn't the world be a better place? So what would that be like? What is he really trying to say? I think there's a lot over the centuries that he saw different, you know, they have some huge monumental, you know, history events, historical events that they frame in this film. And I think that there's a lot there and they can explore it more. And I think that would be better to kind of round out. I'm not saying Chloe Zhao could do it, but someone who had her kind of ethos to continue in this for sure. And it seems to me that a lot of these actors are well known for playing certain parts in TV shows. And so I think it's not like, well, except for Angelina Jolie, you know, it'd be harder for her to do something, but we've seen some of the movie stars say, okay, I'm willing, Paul Bettany, I'm willing to do just this one TV series so that, you know, they can find out a little bit more about Wanda. And so WandaVision was born. And I think that it's possible to do that with some of these because she just kind of gets some of these ideas out there and then they're not explored to the fullest that they could be in such a long film.
Yeah, I agree completely. There are a lot of tantalizing ideas that crop up in this movie. And that's part of what makes it so interesting, for me at least, is there are some really thoughtful ways these stories can go. And it all sort of, at least in the film as it is, sort of comes back around to Icarus and Cersei, which is fine. I thought that was a really well done storyline. But yeah, there are other, those side characters that you could have lost in this film definitely have interesting perspectives on humanity, on civilization, and the history of the world that I agree I would love to see explored. I personally, just as a bit of a history nut, I would love to have seen some of the more historical stuff explored differently. And one of the things that jumped out to me, you actually get to see like early Babylon, which is something that films don't explore. You really do not get to see a lot of early Mesopotamian stuff. Now, as a, you know, I went to seminary, right? So most of our historical stuff is spent in that era at the dawn of human civilization, which is not really something you see portrayed on film. And this film goes there. One of the things I also really liked about it, you know, the whole idea behind the ancient aliens angle is that these Eternals actually become like the heroes of the myths in our cultures. So that at one point they even talk about Thor, you know, the other Marvel character Thor, like Thor followed one of them around as a kid type stuff. So there's all these little hints that they are sort of the hands moving civilization through its stages. One of the things I thought was so interesting, and it shows the thought that went into this film, if you look at their costumes incorporate different symbols from different cultural mythologies. You can look at some of their costumes and see this interesting mix of like Hindu mythology and Egyptian mythology. You'll see recurring symbols there. So there's a lot of thought and care that went into exploring these historical eras that I would love to have seen more of.
Well, I will be interested to see what happens to the Eternals if it was successful enough that they could continue the story somehow, whether it's on Disney Plus or some other venue, maybe another film, probably not by Chloe Zhao, but you'll never see. And I do want to say that I appreciate when a filmmaker, it does cause the fans to be taken aback, I think. But I think films grow on me more when they take a different tact. Before we started this podcast, we were talking a little bit about Star Wars and Rian Johnson's very polarizing film, The Last Jedi. But as I've thought about it more since it came out, I've realized the difference of it was what made it great. And I do think it's a really good film. And so I appreciate that she just didn't do the same old, you know, paint by the numbers type of thing, but she brought something very unique to the Marvel universe.
Yeah, this is a very different film for Marvel. And I enjoyed it. It's a very subversive way of doing storytelling. And that's kind of what leads me to say, I am fairly certain that some of the executives at Disney knew that this film would be polarizing. And you know, credit where it's due, they went ahead and stuck to their guns and did it anyway, to put some interesting ideas out there. So even if it doesn't make Marvel as much money, make Disney as much money as it has in the past, they've got money to spare. So they can take, they're at the point where they can start taking some interesting storytelling risks.
They can take a hit. They've got both Marvel and Star Wars there on their platform. So they've got a lot in their, you know, arsenal so that they can do something different. And I think that's going to actually bring some life into these different you know, IPs, because I think if you keep doing the same old, same old, same old thing for, you know, 20, 30, 40 films, people will start getting very bored.
No, you're absolutely right. This is, again, if you just pay attention to genre studies, and especially in the context of film and cinema, there is only one direction these kinds of stories can go, and these kinds of series, I guess, can go. And if you, you know, she mentioned Zack Snyder. If you read the interview Snyder gives to the New York Times, he gave it right earlier this year, right before his new Justice League came out, or his old Justice League, whatever you want to call it, right before it was released, he talks about how he approached the genre of those films. And he looked at what Marvel was doing, and he saw the trajectory that Disney was lining up. And he said, I wanted to do the opposite of that. I wanted to completely turn the genre sort of on its head from what they were doing. And that's what he did. And you saw the response to it. And this film by Chloe Zhao does something very similar. And again, you see the response to it. So it's something that is subversive in the moment, but over time, like I said, when you have a few more films under your belt and you see the way the story has developed, when you look back, you see it and go, yeah, that actually did something different and brought in some new angles and injected, like you said, some new life into the franchise.
Well, finally, on a much lighter note, I have a couple of rapid fire questions for Cole as we get to know all of our writers a little bit better. So Thanksgiving is coming up later this month. And what's your favorite pie to eat for dessert at your Thanksgiving meal?
Oh, I'm pretty basic. Apple pie.
And of the more obscure Marvel characters out there, which one is one of your favorites?
Obscure characters. Wow. That's actually a tough one as far as obscure characters go. I'm kind of partial to some of the X-Men who are less well known. There was a show that was on a couple of years ago called Legion that follows the character in the comics as Charles Xavier's son, who is an Omega level mutant. Very, very powerful. I'm kind of interested in that character. I'd have to think about my favorite though. It's a tough one.
Well, Cole, thanks for being a guest again on the Postmodern Realities Podcast.
Always appreciate being here. Have a good day.
You've been listening to episode 263 of the Postmodern Realities Podcast, brought to you by the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest was Cole Burgett, who has written an online exclusive film review of Eternals. It's called Free Will, The Power of Choice and Skin in Eternals, and our subscribers can read it for free at our website, equip.org. Please also go to our website, equip.org, to subscribe to our journal.